Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's 2013 budget plan unveiled today and speak about it with Thomas Ferguson, who is on the board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. We will discuss what is not an austerity budget, but one that calls for more taxes on the rich and therefore has no hope of Republican support, but might persuade American voters that it is the path back to economic health. Then, with Greece teetering on default as violent protests leave 45 buildings in Athens burning, we will examine the latest round of austerity measures voted on by an unpopular parliament to ensure a second EU bailout. Kostas Panayiotakis, a professor of sociology at the City University of New York, joins us to discuss how the devastated Greek economy can generate revenues and whether Greece's creditors, the French and German banks, are prepared to take a 90% haircut. Then finally, on a day that an Apple share tops $500, we will look into working conditions in China where Apple's products are assembled. Arun Gupta, the founding editor of the New York City-based independent newspaper, joins us. He has an article at Alternet, iEmpire, Apple's sordid business practices are even worse than you think. I'm now joined by Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And the president unveiled his new 2013 budget today, which includes $1.5 trillion in new taxes, allowing the Bush-era tax cuts to expire. It also includes the Buffett rule, a tax hike on millionaires, as well as infrastructure programs. Altogether, $3.8 trillion plan, but one that is not, the White House insists, is not an austerity budget. And given the tax raises on the wealthy, wouldn't that indicate that this is dead on arrival with the Republicans?
Oh, it's dead on arrival for many reasons. That's certainly a good one. I mean, you also... You've got large numbers of, the super rich who also oppose not only the taxes, but the spending. And, yeah, there's, look, yes, I mean, let's just for a second sort of walk through this sort of, I think you basically got the right framework there, Ian. I mean, this is an election year budget, and as such, it's very different from what we've been hearing from the president. I mean, there's relatively less emphasis on closing the deficit, which was, frankly, he spent the entirety of 2011 and sort of much of when it counted in 2010 pushing on that theme. That sort of receded. And then, you know, it's rather like a lot of other things the administration's been doing, where, you know, they pushed back that Keystone Pipeline. They've been hyping this mortgage agreement, which, so far as I can tell, is actually pretty terrible. And they're doing a bunch of things that make it sound like, finally, they're doing something for the average American. I mean, these guys, you know, the one's first reaction to this, I have to tell you, is, geez, where have they been for the last 3 years? But, you know, even this budget, while it's better than the other, I mean, at least it asks for some taxes from the rich instead of simply cutting them again, which is, of course, what the president did right after the election in 2010 when he was, you know, running all through the election. He was saying, well, he didn't want to extend those tax cuts for the super rich. And then he turns around right after it and does it. And, you know, now he is asking for that. He's also asking for the I was just looking at the budget just before I got on here. You know, he's also asked for the repeal of that ludicrous carried interest provision, which allows private equity firms to sort of treat their work income, you know, as some kind of investment income instead of what it is for the rest of us.
Right. They pay 15% if they pay anything at all. And that is what Mitt Romney's been a beneficiary of among other private equity head fund managers.
Yes, look, one has to say here that I think the Romney candidacy, whatever else it's done, has been a great education for the population. I suspect that a lot of people have suddenly now come to understand how the tax code works. In that sense, I think the president's likely to help himself a little bit with this. But, you know, as you say, it is dead on arrival. It's not going to happen. The plain fact of the matter is that, you know, this is the only time we've been hearing this from him, really, in a sort of concentrated manner. So forgive me if I don't turn handsprings. And I have to comment, too, it's like the White House still refuses to grasp the fundamental problem. You know, the fundamental problem is that well over 8% of the workforce, I mean, really maybe closer to 16 or 17%, with a lot of folks dropping out of the workforce, so they're not counted at all, is unemployment. And after three years on the job, these folks have still not proposed anything that is going to make a really big dent in that. And yes, their budget is different from the Republicans, who do nothing at all on that. But it's becoming crazy. I mean, anybody who could stop and think about this for 5 seconds could realize it can't make sense to just keep paying people to be unemployed. It would be much cheaper and much better for everybody if they were paid to work. I mean, you know, these guys, the White House here, they look good only compared to the Republicans.
And Thomas Ferguson, again, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking, and a contributing editor to The Nation. The president says this is not about class warfare. It's about national or the nation's welfare. Do you think there's a chance then, given the gridlock Congress, that he can persuade the American voters, many of whom are very upset and anxious, one in four homes are underwater? Do you think he can make the case that this is the best way back to prosperity, while the Republicans and the push the Ryan plan and bring back the specter that we're broke, and try to make the analogy between the federal debt and the personal debt, and that this is the big problem we face, not unemployment, and not the recession.
Yeah, he might, you know, if people are listening to the argument, he'll probably win it against the Republicans. The problem is a lot of folks may not listen too much to the argument. They will simply compare what's actually happened over the last 3 years, which is also, frankly, a rational point of view. And there they're likely to conclude that the president's fallen short. So I think this is going to be something of a problem. I also think when you look into that budget, you can see some really foolish things, of which, you know, the cuts in defense actually are really pretty small. They come mostly from just the withdrawal from Iraq and the beginnings of withdrawal in Afghanistan. You haven't had any fundamental effort to try to sort of sort through what the U.S. actually could afford to spend on defense and what it needs. Just look at that huge open-ended commitment to the Pacific defense, that the perimeter that the president, you know, announced a couple of months ago when he went out to Australia. I mean, you know, anybody who thinks about this for 5 seconds realizes that 500 or 2,500 Marines sitting in Australia are not going to deter anybody from doing anything. I mean, in some fundamental sense, those Marines' guns are pointed not at the Chinese, but at Mitt Romney. They're there to defense the claim that the president hasn't done enough, from the usual "we must spend everything on defense" crowd. That tends to completely dominate the Republicans and has a big chunk of the Democrats. But, you know, they're not confronting the fundamental reality here, which is, you know, the huge threat to American defense in the medium run is the low rate of economic growth in the United States. It's sort of the flip side of the unemployment problem. You can spend all the money you want putting aircraft carriers or Marines out in the Western Pacific, but every year what's going to happen, and what has been happening, is the sort of the growth of the Chinese economy makes them more and more friends and clients in all those neighboring countries. And in 5 or 10 years, it simply will not matter how many, you know, bristling military forces you've got sitting there. It's just everybody will be doing business with the Chinese because the American economy just withers away. This is like a total failure to get the point. Instead, the Americans keep sending, you know, Kurt Campbell out there, the Assistant Secretary for Asian, basically just talks tough. This doesn't make any sense. This is a losing hand. It can't win.
Thomas Ferguson, let me touch on a couple of or several of the points in this budget that was unveiled today before a bunch of students in Virginia. The president says that we're going to save $41 billion over 10 years by closing tax loopholes for oil, gas, and coal companies. That's popular, although that's the most powerful lobby in Washington. They're up there with them, right?
We won't argue.
Right. Then he says we can generate $61 billion over 10 years through a tax on financial institutions to recover the costs of the bailout. That sounds good. Again, you're up against the bank lobby. Saving $25 billion over 11 years and spending cuts for the Post Service. I mean, the Postal Service being devastated by ludicrous congressional restraints on them to prepay all of their pensions for 75 years.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know why he's going after the post office. It's a complete catastrophe what the Congress has done to the post office. Then you've got cutting spending on health care by $364 billion. That's ambitious, and it's going after the vendors. Investing $476 billion in infrastructure projects. That's a spending thing. With $50 billion immediate cash for transportation, $30 billion to upgrade schools, $30 billion to hire teachers, police, and firemen. So the last one is the antithesis of an austerity budget, right?
Well, if it's the antithesis of an austerity, it's more like a small gesture.
Right. But again, no snowball's chance in hell.
Yeah, we probably ought to just say a word about this college tuition business. I mean, basically, that's just another example of the kind of utterly fraudulent liberalism that you're now peddling there. I mean, the fundamental issue in American education, higher education in particular, is that the state and the government pay less and less as a percentage of the total cost. Now, it's fine to tell colleges to sort of restrain their tuition, but, you know, what are they supposed to do as their costs rise? What they need is some serious federal programs there. Students don't need help in loans. They need help in paying for college there. And, you know, nothing the president's talking about is going to do very much about this problem. And the one effective thing they could do to force some really serious comparison shopping among colleges on the basis of real information around them, they make only gestures in. And this is pure claptrap. It's pure junk.
Well, but Tom Ferguson, let's face it, the government does spend up, I think it's around $40 billion of our taxpayer money on for-profit education, which is a complete racket. It's now ending up becoming the new subprime bubble. Wall Street's getting in on the act. They take federal dollars, give them to these phony shingles. They sucker, just like they did with the subprime housing, they sucker minority students and vets in there, saddle them with a monstrous debt, and give them a worthless diploma. And that's a complete bipartisan scam.
Well, not quite. That's been, in truth, Ian, that's been more. John Boehner was the big champion of that in the House. It was he who was pushing the sort of efforts to cut early in the Obama administration. The administration made a couple of efforts. I have to say this for them. They did try to rein in the privates. They've had Republican opposition every step of the way. I mean, and that it's not totally by. I wouldn't.
Right. Well, there are a lot of lobbyists from on the Democratic side, like the former Senate Majority Leader and others, that are lobbying for the for-profit schools. The Washington Post Company, of course, it makes all of its money from Kaplan, a for-profit school.
Yep. I'm not disagreeing. We're not in any disagreement
right.
here on this.
But we, I'm surely agree that it's one of the most egregious. Absolutely disgraceful wastes of federal money, and it's immoral how kids are ripped off with taxpayer money. That money could be going towards what you were just saying earlier, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would add that the way the sort of keep letting the private finance folks, banks, and others into the college lending, where they mark up the loans way up, when the government can do that very cheaply and does a very good job on that. I mean, that has been, yeah, that's just, it's like the craziest national education policy anyone could possibly design. It's really nuts.
Well, just in closing, Tom Ferguson, given that this, we're sort of talking about the big headline today, which is sort of meaningless. I hate doing this because, you know, I'm trying to find out what's really going on in the world, and this just feels like such theater because you've got a completely gridlocked and obstructionist Congress,
right.
And you got an election year. And I guess the president, you know, he can't get anything passed in the Senate unless he has 60 votes.
Right.
I mean, that's a surreal usurpation of power that, I don't know, nobody seems to talk about it, but...
Look, well, you don't want me to get started. This is only a 15-minute interview. I mean, I do a fair amount of work on this. Huh. We know we have the best Congress money can buy, and yes, that results in... sort of partisan gridlock. You know, this is not coming from voters. I mean, this is just idiotic to claim that voters really want that. They don't. How many minutes would you like to give me to sort of excoriate this whole thing? Yeah, look, I regret to say that this is one of those moments when you just look at the democratic process and you want to just put your head in your hands and cry, or just try to dream of something else for a few minutes. Because this is a tale told of full of sound and fury, and it signifies nothing.
Well, I think Macbeth, the quote from Macbeth is a tale told by idiots, isn't it?
I did deliberately drop. A lot of these people are very able. They know exactly what they are doing.
Right. And we, the people, are getting the great shaft. Well,
I thank
you for joining us here, Tom. We're going to try and get hold of your documentary, too. We're hoping to have it here today as a premium.
It's about
Golden Rule, the book that you've written, which really explains how the power of money has supplanted the power of people, right?
Yeah, I have to say, my usual injunction here, if you want a happy ending, see a Disney movie.
Well, thank you for joining.
This is a problem.
Thank you for joining us here today, Thomas Ferguson.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kostas Panayiotikos, who's a professor of sociology at New York University College of Technology at the City University of New York, and the author of Remaking Scarcity, From Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kostas Panayiotikos.
Good to be with you.
And clearly, things are extremely tense in Greece as protests over the last few days have burnt 45 buildings, have been gutted by fire, and the parliament voted in these harsh austerity measures demanded by foreign banks. There is also an election coming up, right, where the Conservatives are likely to win, and the Conservatives are the people who ran up the debt in collusion with people like Goldman Sachs. So what's your sense of Greece's immediate future, not to mention its long-term future?
Yeah. First of all, the whole question of elections is a bit up in the air. The current government, headed by an unelected former banker, was set up precisely so that Greek citizens did not have a say over this rescue package and the attached austerity measures that will determine the fate of Greek society for at least the coming decade. So basically, Greeks have been under austerity for the last 2 years, and they have seen that these measures have not worked. They have pushed Greek society into a depression and have not even addressed the fiscal issue, because it's hard to service your debt when your income is shrinking, which is what is happening in Greece. Hence the popular anger. And what we have is that the two, I would have said major parties, but one of them, the socialists, who presided for 2 years over the austerity measures, is not even a major party any longer. They have gone from 43% to 8%, according to recent polls. But these two parties, they still have the overwhelming majority of the seats in the parliament. And they only have this majority because, you know, that reflects the balance of forces 2 years ago. And this balance of forces is no longer valid. And they know that if there were elections now, Greeks might give a very different answer, and they might not, and they would not go along with these austerity measures. So basically, we are having measures that are being pushed that are very destructive, and people are rising up against them because they don't agree with them. But we basically have a parliament that no longer represents Greek citizens, that just continues the same failed recipe.
So where are the revenues going to come from, given the economic conditionings are worsening? Where are the revenues to come from to pay off these debts, even assuming that the bankers take a 50% haircut, which they've been reluctant to do so far?
Well, I think at this point the Greek government has to basically tell its creditors that it cannot service the debt. It has to stop paying the debt, servicing the debt for the foreseeable future, and try to use, revenues for to sort of come to an understanding with other European countries to sort of towards a new, a different kind of trajectory. This doesn't work. And Greece does have some leverage because basically it's not clear that the Europeans can afford to let Greece collapse. That's the only bargaining chip Greece has at this moment. The Europeans are sort of prepared to play hardball with Greece and to blackmail and sort of, and that's what they've been doing. But I think the Greek government has to, use its own leverage to negotiate an agreement that is better for Greek people and ultimately better for the European population as a whole. Because what we're seeing is that these austerity policies in Greece are now being generalized across the board throughout the European continent. And the result is that Europe is now facing a double dip recession, and unemployment is rising across Europe. And that instead of containing the Greek crisis, we see the debt crisis spreading throughout Europe, so that we're reaching a point where even the future of the euro is in doubt. So there are always alternatives. I mean, the Greek government and the Europeans are trying to convince the Greek population that there is no alternative, that these harsh measures that have destroyed Greek society and the living conditions of Greek people are the only possible response. This is not true, but it takes strong movements of resistance and a different kind of government that comes out of these movements to actually push towards a different direction.
Again, I'm speaking with Kostas Panayiotikos, a professor of sociology at New York City College of Technology at the City University of New York. He's the author of Remaking Scarcity from Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. I understand that, I mean, I guess to summarize what you're telling us, Kostas, is that in effect, the only leverage that Greece has is to sort of on the one hand, the Europeans are holding a gun to Greece's head. On the other hand, Greece is holding a gun to their own head. And they're saying, you know, if we commit suicide, you all go down with us. And or at least the whole Euro project starts to unravel. It's a kind of leverage. I guess you could almost describe it as the Samson syndrome, right, where Samson pulls down the temple on top of himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of obviously a difficult situation. And in a way, this is a situation that reflects the broader imbalances of the Eurozone and the architecture of the Eurozone. Because the way this crisis is presented right now is to say that, Greeks and the Southern Europeans have been irresponsible, they have been living beyond their means, and now they're trying to take advantage of the virtuous neighbors to the north. But the reality, of course, is that the great beneficiaries from the Eurozone project have been northern European countries, especially, German industrial capital that had easy access to the markets of southern Europe, and that has basically wiped out the productive capacity of weaker countries like Greece. So what you have is basically a project where the North has profited significantly from this European project. And this has created imbalances, and now that there is a crisis, the imbalances have come to the fore, partly because of the global capitalist crisis, and they sort of want to interpret the crisis in a way that justifies victimizing ordinary, Greek workers and citizens and workers and citizens across southern Europe for a crisis they didn't cause. So this is the kind of crisis sort of shows the contradictions of neoliberal capitalism more generally, the contradictions we've had, similar contradictions with neoliberal globalization that has contributed to the eruption of the global crisis. And we now realize that, or we should realize, that we need to look for different ways of organizing our economy, ways that will be less unequal, where the benefits will not be primarily concentrated in the hands of the economically more powerful groups and countries, and systems that will be also more egalitarian, more democratic, and therefore more stable as well.
So, Kostas Panayiotikos, you talk about how German workers are being pitted against Greek workers, but there is a difference, though. My understanding is that German workers and Germany in general, Germans in general, pay their taxes, and they pay fairly high taxes, but they also get a lot of government services, which we don't here in this country. We pay low taxes, even though conservatives say that we pay high taxes, but we get very poor government services. Now, The difference, though, my understanding is that it's fairly endemic in Greece not to pay taxes, and the government recently put forth a kind of name and shame list of thousands of prominent Greeks who don't pay their taxes, entertainers, sports figures, etc. How did that work out?
Well, I mean, it remains to be seen whether this will lead to real change. I mean, tax evasion is a real issue in Greece, although I should note here that Greek workers do pay their taxes. They don't have an option not to pay their taxes.
So it's the rich Greeks who don't pay their taxes, right?
Who don't pay their taxes.
Right.
And also, of course, the problem has been aggravated by the policy of governments in the past that actually also reduced the taxes for businesses. So I think, this is a real issue, and tax evasion of the rich has to be addressed. But the two parties that have dominated the political system in recent decades, the socialists and the conservatives, have not shown any political will to address this issue. They've been making some moves in recent months, but the fact remains that most of the burden of the taxation in recent months has been borne once again by ordinary, workers and citizens in Greece. That might be conceivably change in the future, but it is less likely to change if the same parties continue to, hold power. And, of course, the polls show that support for these parties is not very, very high. I mean, the socialists are almost liquidated in polls. And the conservatives, as you mentioned, are doing better, but even their performance is not that spectacular. It's not clear they could form a government by themselves if there were elections today. And given the about turn they have made recently, I mean, up to a few months ago, they were sort of opposing the austerity measures, and that sort of helped them electorally. Now they are identified with these measures. They have made an about turn, and I wouldn't be surprised if their support even for the conservatives starts going down.
Well, just in closing then, Kostas Panayiotakos, in order to get out from under this burgeoning and debt that has been rolled over for the last couple of years, my understanding is that Greek creditors would have to take about a 90% haircut for this to even be attainable in terms of servicing this debt. And that's politically unlikely. So what is the chances then of a default? Because at the end of the day, it's beginning to look like that's the only realistic option, and they keep sort of papering over it. But that seems to be, and I don't know how you could ever go back to the drachma. That would be even more economic pain, surely.
Well, I think it's true that Greece is bankrupt. I mean, a default in one way or another is inevitable, and even, the current package restructuring the debt is a form of default. And I think what the Greek government has to do and what the Greek people should be struggling for is basically defaulting in ways that are sort of most consistent with the interests of ordinary Greeks. Right now, what we're seeing is a kind of process of Greek default that is happening under terms that are most consistent with the interests of foreign creditors. So the default will happen one way or another. The question is, the question is the way of the default and whether the way this default happens primarily, serves the interest of ordinary Greeks or whether it serves the interests of, European banks and the capitalist elites in Greece and Europe.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kostas Panayiotakis.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kostas Panayiotakis, a professor of sociology at New York City College of Technology at the City University of New York, and he's the author of the new book, Remaking Scarcity, From Capitalist Inefficiency to Economic Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Apple's dirty secret in China.
Is a prison, and these people aren't your friends. There's guards at the on-ramps, armed to the teeth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Arun Gupta, the founding editor of the New York City-based Independent newspaper. That's Independent with a Y. He is writing a book on the decline of the American empire and has an article at Alternet, iEmpire, Apple's sordid business practices are even worse than you think. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arun Gupta.
Great to be with you today.
And my understanding is, I guess, a propitious moment to be talking about Apple, Arun, given that Apple's stock just topped to $500 today.
Yeah, well, it's either the first or second largest corporation in the world, which is quite astonishing, especially when you consider just about a decade ago, Apple was all but dead. So in many ways, you know, from the financial market perspective and the consumer market perspective, Apple is quite a wonder story. But when we look into the face behind the iPad, there's actually quite a real ugly backstory in how these products come to the market in the United States and how Apple's just gargantuan, almost unimaginable profits are built off of what, you know, looks like horrendous labor practices in China.
So let's talk then about Foxconn, which seems to be, that seems to be the main supplier and the main builder of iPhones. What percentage of Apple's product line are Foxconn responsible for, Arun?
Apparently 100%. Now, what Foxconn does is they are actually just assembling the products. And, you know, these items are really, they're incredibly sophisticated. The late, great science fiction author Clark had this line about the more sophisticated technology gets, the more it appears like magic. And so to hold something, you know, like an iPad or iPhone where you can do all these amazing things just with the swipe of your fingers, it does seem to have this magical quality, and it's this product purely of technology. But in fact, Foxconn relies on a workforce just in China of 1.2 million workers to create the consumer electronics. And what they're doing is they're getting the components from something like 150 other suppliers and puts them together. And this involves very minute, detailed work by hand. It's not robots who are putting it together. In fact, it's humans, but who are turned into flesh and blood robots by Foxconn's management practices. And there's been some recent, there's been a good bit of recent reporting on this, including a New York Times series called The Eye Economy. And when I started investigating it, what I found is that the reality is actually far worse than what the New York Times talks about, because it focused mainly on issues of overtime, forced overtime, and of some of the environmental conditions in the plants. But it turns out that Foxconn deliberately uses this military-style discipline system. They, according to Foxconn workers themselves, they regularly engage in corporal punishment. They use just a vast amount of what is essentially forced labor. One of the most shocking aspects is that Foxconn contracts with hundreds of vocational schools and universities throughout China to supply them with interns, and these interns have virtually no rights, and the interns report that they're forced to take these quote-unquote internships working on the Foxconn assembly line, or they'll be denied their certificates or not allowed to graduate. In one case, the Hainan provincial government is supplying about 100,000 interns a year to Foxconn. And so it's really just quite barbaric, the labor practices that Foxconn uses. And the thing we have to remember about Apple, this is a company that is absolutely obsessed with design. I think one of the most telling anecdotes about Steve Jobs is this is a man who was so obsessed with design, it took him 2 years to decide on a washing machine for his home. So the implication of this is that Apple knows precisely what is going on in these factories because they want to make sure that these products are built exactly to their specifications. And the other side of this is, of course, they are a huge and enormous corporation, and they're interested in returning shareholder value. And so that means beating down the price as much as possible, which means control, having absolute minute control of the supply chain. And the result of this is, on the one hand, in the last quarter of 2011, Apple returned more than $13 billion in profit. That is just absolutely stunning. That's not revenue, that's profit. They're one of the most profitable companies in the world, which is why their stock is now over $500. On a split-adjusted basis, it's gone up nearly 100 times in the last decade. That's a 10,000% return. But these profit this profit is based on these horrendous labor practices because they're trying to squeeze everything out of the workers. And one executive who worked with Apple Computer, Apple, told the New York Times that, you know, Apple goes in there, they look at the whole supply chain and control it, and they force the price down, and then what they do is they come back next year and demand a 10% pay cut. So whereas Apple's margins are over 30%, its profit margin is over 30%, Foxconn is just going for market share. And at this point, they assemble something like half the world's consumer electronics. Meanwhile, their profit margin is about 1.5%. So this is the dichotomy. Of course, no one should cry for Foxconn because the chairman and owner of Foxconn, Terry Gu, a Taiwanese businessman, is worth reportedly $5.7 billion. But this is what the whole economic model is based on. And in much of the reporting that's come out about these labor practices, they're kind of presented as incidental or as an unintended consequence. And thus this is something that, you know, Apple should be able to correct. Rather, if you look at what all the, there are plenty of NGO groups, there are labor groups who are going into China, they're sending investigators to take jobs at Foxconn. There's one particular group called Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehavior, which is based in Hong Kong. They've interviewed, along with other academics, over 2,000 Foxconn workers in the last 2 years. You know, they're finding a much different type of system where these practices are really absolutely inherent to the production system. You know, and I can explain real quickly. Essentially, on the production line, it's only going to move as fast as the slowest worker. So So they rigidly control the whole rhythm of the assembly line. They have cameras everywhere. They have supervisors everywhere. If you make a mistake, they will publicly humiliate you. You're forced to stand up and give a confession. They force workers to spend hours copying the quotations of Terry Gou for no pay. And then there was this one study done by a group of academics where they interviewed 1,700 Foxconn workers. And one in six, nearly 300, said they were subject to some sort of violent corporal punishment. Now, this is a bit of a broad category. It can include everything from being forced to kneel in a gesture of humiliation and submission to being actually physically beaten in some manner. And other reports have recorded incidents, says of Foxconn workers being beaten. The Foxconn police and security force is like a law unto itself. It doesn't allow in the regular police force. And there is even videos circulating on the internet of one incident in which Foxconn guards are beating workers in the open. So it's actually a pretty barbaric system that is behind the iPad, and that's what people need to understand, that these practices are exactly how Apple is able to produce tens of millions of products, to crank out new generation after new generation. You know, there's been five generations of iPhones in 4 years, and how they're able to meet and exceed Wall Street expectations for these vast profits.
Again, I'm speaking with Arun Gupta, who's the founding editor of the New York City-based independent newspaper. He's writing a book on the decline of the American empire and has an article at Altnet, iEmpire, Apple's sordid business practices are even worse than you think. Just to quote from your article here, some of the stunning statistics, Arun. Foxconn's factories employed 1.3 million people in China, up to 50% of that workforce are students. They sign contracts with the students, but the company doesn't have to pay into social welfare insurance. Many of these students are, in fact, have no connection to electronics. But the schools that sell these huge pools of labor get vast kickbacks, and the highest paid of the students work 11 hours a day, 7 days a week, with a maximum salary of 500 won, which is less than $80 a month.
Yeah, I mean it is really quite horrendous. The 56% figure is actually a little bit of speculation. This is what the group Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehavior were told. But we do know from press reports that the Hainan government alone is providing, in 2010 and 2011, 100,000 interns a year. The Chongqing provincial government has also announced that it's going to provide 100,000 interns. And yes, according to various other reports, you have students who are in automotive repair, in hotel management, in journalism, locksmithing, who nothing to do with consumer electronics, who are essentially forced to go work at Foxconn. And they're sent from one province to Foxconn's, what was Foxconn's main plant in Shenzhen, which is basically right next to Hong Kong. And this plant is absolutely stunning in scale. It's called Foxconn City because this facility alone employs something like 400,000 people. Now, in 2010, there were all these very dramatic public suicides. In at one point in May of 2010, there were six Foxconn workers who ended up successfully committing suicide. There were other suicide attempts by jumping off the buildings. And the usual excuse is like, oh, well, in such a huge workforce, you know, the statistic is well in lines with the average. And Steve Jobs, in fact, even said that when he was confronted with these suicides. But, you know, what would we say if in the space of a year a dozen people had killed themselves by jumping off of Walmart buildings? You know, the whole thing about when someone jumps to their deaths, it's a very public act. And these were workers who essentially, had pinned all their hopes on getting a factory job like this, and what instead they find is these absolutely brutal conditions. You know, they're forced to live in these facilities because they can be minutely controlled, because they can be forced to work 300 hours a month, and the only way they can make any sort of real pay is to do huge amounts of overtime. They're put into these dorm rooms where you can barely squeeze in the room, that there's so many bunk beds. And then, you know, like I mentioned, there's the military-style discipline that begins from the recruitment phase, where the workers who are recruited, even before they're hired, they're forced to stand like military units in the sun for hours.
Now, these are as young as 16, right, these kids?
Apparently even younger. You know, there's a Mike Daisy who's been doing this one-man show, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, and he's a self-professed Apple fanboy, but he wanted to see what was behind it. Now, the interns, yes, they are as young as 16. When he went to China, he actually went there and had a translator and went to the Foxconn plant. And he said he was meeting kids who were 14, 13, even 12 years old, you know, and it's just like it's obvious, you know, that they're employing children. And then Apple makes a big deal. Oh, we do all these audits, you know, we have all these auditing firms who go in and they don't find, you know, and there's these occasional violations. And it's like, look, you know, the company knows when the auditors are coming in. So what they do is they just pull everyone off the assembly line and they put the older workers on there. I mean, these audits are for paper, literally, only. You know, all that Apple cares about, its profit is based on constantly churning out new models. It dreams up, you know, a new product line, and then boom, within less than a year, just from the idea, you have billions of units, tens of million units on the store shelves. And what's a real common factor is the abuse of the workforce. And I wasn't able to get into this really in my article, but there is actually a very important point that these scholars in China, in Hong Kong, had done this comparative study of Taiwanese factories in China and Vietnam. And the thing we should remember about Vietnam, it's a much poorer country. It's compared to China, it's smaller, so it has much less economic and political clout. Yet the workers in Vietnam were educated about their rights. The trade unions there are somewhat more independent on the government and more aggressive. The effect was workers were treated much better and were not just treated, they were much more aggressive about enforcing their rights. They wouldn't work the type of overtime that would happen in the Taiwanese factories in China. And so this is the thing that often gets left out also, is the role of the state. You know, China is this state-managed authoritarian capitalism, and they play a huge role in terms of managing the economy, managing the labor force, massive subsidies and tax breaks that allows the so-called free market to function. And in fact, when you look at the case of Foxconn and just the vast amount of subsidies they get, you know, the roads, the plants, the dormitories, the transportation, they build new airports, you know, on and on and on. Well, we start to see it's not a free market, you know, that it is the state is coming in and doing all this work that allows for the accumulation of private profit. Then on top of that, what they do is they very rigidly manage the labor force. They have this complicated system of migrant registration. So when you leave your home province, you basically don't have any rights. And this is why the workforce is so abused in China, that you have all these migrant workers, and the students are migrant workers themselves. They're forced to work in other provinces. And so they don't have any real political rights, and they're not educated about their labor rights. So it's a situation that's absolutely ripe for systematic abuse. And this is what we see going on in these factories.
So Arun Gupta, just in closing then, my understanding is that there's an enormous amount of corruption in government circles in China, and you have the dual government in China. You have the Communist Party apparatchiks who have arbitrary power, and then you have the government people sort of operating in tandem, if you will. I take it that Terry Gou, the billionaire $5.7 billion head of Foxconn, he's probably not averse to kicking back a little money. I mean, if they're bribing the schools to provide this indentured hundreds of thousands of indentured students, they're probably the very stuff that you're talking about, the favors the government give them. There's probably some bribery involved in that, surely.
Sure, I don't have any allegations or evidence. You know, I don't have any evidence to support those allegations. But you know, is the system ripe for abuse? Of course it is. And who wouldn't be demanding that they get a cut of this money? So I'm sure there's a lot of these kind of private deals being cut. But I think the noteworthy thing is how it is built into the system. You know, that the student interns who are forced to work 3 months, 6 months, or even up to a year in factories, and it's not just Foxconn. What apparently happens in a lot of instances is that they are paying the full wage, but then the school is getting paid a tuition. So the full wage might work out to be, say, like closer to $200 a month, but the students are only getting $50 a month. So the schools are getting all this kickback. And I was looking at the case of one school where the students were getting only $50 a month, and it was 500 students. And I did the numbers, and it's just like over the course of the year, that works out to $1 million for this one school. And that is serious money. So, I mean, it's really, they're selling essentially these indentured laborers to the factories. And this wasn't an issue that I was able to get into, but I can bet you that I'm sure this violates all sorts of U.S. laws that we have to remember, that, there are laws that the United States does have on the book about labor practices for products that are sold in the United States. And so this could easily, if there was any sort of legal way, tutorial weight given, they could go after Apple. The Justice Department could probably easily go after Apple and demand to look into these labor practices and say this is illegal. They sure can't stop them for building this product in China, but they say you can't then sell it in the U.S. But of course, right, they're not going to do it because Apple is such a powerful company.
Right, and American consumers would only have to pay about $20 extra for people to have decent rights in China, and probably another $40 or $50 extra to have them manufactured over here. So I thank you so much for joining us, Arun Gupta, for fascinating and comprehensive work that you've done. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Arun Gupta, the founding editor of the New York City-based Independent newspaper. He's writing a book on the decline of the American empire and has an article at Alternet, iEmpire, Apple's sordid business practices are even worse than you think. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.